Okay, I'm just going to talk about a few things and see what happens. Now, last time I talked about the white knight syndrome, and I've got some more ideas about that. We'll see if we get to those this time. But I wanted to talk about naming and the danger of naming and labeling today. The most inconsequential aspect of something is its name. Have you ever thought about that? We think names are so important. The first time we meet someone, we ask invariably, "What's your name?" As if that would tell us something about the person. But does it really? I'm not sure it does. It's like calling a rose a rose. Osho always says, "You call a rose, but can you experience the rose?" You see, once the mind has the idea that it's understood something, that it's been able to label something, then it puts it in a drawer somewhere. Oh, this is a rose. You look at it, classify it, separate it from yourself because it has a different name. Interesting, Adam in the garden, also naming all the animals. This is connected. And then you put it away, you get rid of it. And then you go to the next thing to name. When really the experience of a rose, I dare you to try and convey that to someone with any degree of accuracy. What is it like to feel a rose, to smell a rose? What's the experience like? In many ways, the experience of a rose happens on so many levels, meta levels, levels that do not possess words. It's almost like an interdimensional experience, if you think about it. And yet we reduce it to a single word, a single concept, a single idea, and think we've got it. Now, children don't do this. Children experience things, and they may want to know what they're called so they can refer to them. But when they experience a rose, it's about the rose. You see them holding it, looking at it, maybe smelling it, rubbing it against their skin. It's about the experience. And this can tell us a lot for life. Life is not meant to be categorized, analyzed, cut apart, and categorized that way. Life is meant to be experienced. It's just like if you take my hand and you want to analyze my hand. Well, if you want to completely understand my hand, think some people, then first of all, I need to cut it off. Then I need to look at all the veins and bones and skin and muscles and everything else that my hand consists of. And then as I go deeper, I peel back more and more layers, and maybe I want to know what the bones consist of. So then I pull out a microscope and start looking at that, and I find there's cells, and then maybe I want to know what the cells are made out of. So I pull out an electron microscope. Well, maybe not pull out because they're pretty big and heavy, but then I take an electron microscope and I look at it. And I go down deeper into it and I find there's electrons and protons and neutrons. And then I want to understand what those are made out of. And so I look even deeper and then I find quarks. And basically, what we're going to find, think some, is no matter how deep you dig, you'll always find new levels. And you can do that forever. However, the question is, do I understand the hand now? Do I understand what the hand can do? The hand can play piano, the hand can give massage. What else can the hand do? But only as one complete whole, as part of the body. The hand becomes irrelevant without context. And this is our scientific method that we apply many times. It's chopping things into ever smaller bits in the hope of understanding them, but we divorce them from their context. And this is what we do when we label a rose simply a rose. And this is what the left brain does. This is what the logical mind does. This is what it is supposed to do. It classifies things, organizes things. But we also have to give some credence to the right brain, to the feminine part of us, to the yin, to the part that sees everything connected. They always say that women are multitaskers, that they see everything as one big whole. The whole village has to be running. A baby can't cry in the other room during lovemaking, otherwise lovemaking is stopped for the woman, right? And this is an important thing that men need to learn, and also what women need to allow more into their lives, is the holistic processing of information, which on an intuitive level happens sometimes so powerfully, so strongly, so quickly, and with such a lack of an ability to name what's going on, that you don't know why you know what you know, if that makes any sense. So sometimes that connectedness leads us to places where we find ourselves feeling or doing things or inspired or from getting intuition to do things, and we don't know why we're even doing them and why we even feel how we feel, because the information that's connected is coming in so fast and being processed by a completely different part of us that the conscious mind that labels and separates has no chance to actually process it. People say we process something like 0.2% of the information given to us. If you consciously, you know, I'm looking at a shelf of books right now. If I had to consciously process the title of every book, I would see speaking for about, I don't know, minutes while I had read every single title on every single book before I understood it. But that's not necessary. It's been proven that your subconscious, your unconscious, your right brain can see a whole shelf of books once and have the entire thing memorized. And people have access to this part of themselves, and that's their, and we call that a photographic memory, for example. But you can briefly see a license plate in a car accident, and when you're able to deeply relax and access the right brain content, the intuitive things, it's just there. So a lot of the things that we experience, in fact, the lion's share, are just going in and getting stored somewhere in our brain's systems, which are unbelievably large and complex. And we don't have time to classify them. And it's not important that we classify them. We decide consciously, okay, this is the part that I want to chop apart, that I want to understand deeply. And what we don't realize, and this was presented very strongly in Tertium Organum, by Ouspensky, which Osho recommends very strongly, is the book that he underlined every word of the whole book. Very sort of difficult philosophical book, but it's an important one. And basically, our senses and the sensory input we get, we have five senses, and however they process information, we have no guarantee that that's real, that that's the authentic way it is. One person sees blue and sees blue, another person sees it and calls it green. You see, our labeling is the separation mechanism for us. Our definitions of things are the separation mechanism. And then we can start a fight based upon what color is really there, right? But what color is really there? Well, we have no objective way of knowing, really. We have consensus reality based upon what we think is going on, but we have no proof about what the true color is of any given thing in the universe, for example. And since we don't know that, and since we're limited to our senses for all of our experience from the outside, unless you, you know, count sixth sense and intuition, which I'm talking about, then we have no way of objectively really knowing anything. But we have to act as if we do, because that's the information that we have. So I just want to caution, and the reason for this whole rant is the fact that we don't understand things as much as we think we understand them, and that we need to simply look at our ability to consciously experience in the moment instead of judging, labeling, evaluating, analyzing, and splitting apart things which we're experiencing right now. Now, the labeling goes to an even deeper place. Labeling goes to a place where we get beliefs placed upon us through language. We get beliefs placed about God, about family, about our school, about our a religion, about our country, about all these things, and these are based in words. So people spend a lot of time and a lot of energy hammering specific concepts into our heads. Concepts like your parents love you, your country is worth fighting for, God that we worship is the right one, etc., etc. And what we develop from these conglomerations of words, we see that words are the key. When you're a child, you're sort of still in Eden. And when you develop a bit, you come to the point where you see, okay, I can use words to get things. If I say water, my thirst can be stilled. If I say food, then I can get something to eat. If I'm hungry, and get that need met. So words become magic, and all magic is based on words. Or we're trying to really influence the environment. And it is a little bit magical when I can say, Mom, I'm thirsty, and I get water. It's conjuring, if that makes sense. And once we see that words work to conjure, to create things from nothing, so to speak, we are taught and start to use words for all sorts of things, for all sorts of concepts, which we can't verify. And it's the first step that's always true, water, drink, food, and it's later steps that aren't. So when language becomes more complex, we get taught all these things about love and joy and peace and community and sacrifice and loyalty and friendship and all of these abstract concepts, honesty and truth and depth. And all of this language is used, or very often can be used, but actually is used, to move us, to move our behavior. Instead of trusting our experience again, what actually happens to us when we try something, we can be told, oh, your mother loves you, even if she beats you. Right? So, okay, so you have this contrary thing, this love, this beautiful picture, this image, this hypnosis, this thing that you've been taught to believe. And then you can be given words that completely gloss over and change the meaning of your experience. And so what you're taught to do at some point in your life is to disregard your experience and instead believe in the words. And this is the root of all evil, so to speak. This is the knowing good and evil. This is the separation into the various facets of reality. And from this come our beliefs. And from our beliefs come virtually all of our problems. So then we start to believe things that are based on words. I'm a good person. I'm a bad person. I'm loving. I'm loved. I'm not loving. I'm not worthy of love. I'm important. People care about me. People don't care about me. People will never care about me. It's easy to get ahead. It's hard to get ahead. What I do matters. What I do doesn't matter. I'm important. I'm not important. You see, all of these different concepts and these beliefs provide then a cage of literally words, a cage of beliefs around what we're experiencing. And when we start to move that into our heads, then we develop concepts like, well, because my mother didn't treat me right, I can't be successful in this life. And we run a whole program living our entire lives according to a belief, which is just a series of words, in our head that's completely divorced from the actual experience that we may be having in this moment. So most people are connected to those beliefs and those labels completely. And I would invite us to move back into our experience, like a child does. Move away from the label, and move away from the belief, and go back to your experience. You know, am I being beaten now? No. Okay. Good. So, am I free to do what I want now? Yes. If I do some things, do emotions come up? Perhaps. And in that case, deal with them as they come up. Don't create labels and concepts about them so you think you know what'll happen and what'll be true before it even happens. And this is where we get to my favorite topic of all, which is meditation. So the process of meditation enables you to divorce yourself from your beliefs for a moment to see what is really going on inside you. How do you do that? Well, simply by sitting silently, observing your body, all of a sudden you're in the experience of the moment. Instead of being in some conceptual reality about how things are or are not at the moment. And don't get me wrong, there's hundreds of different methods of motivation, meditation. Just simply sitting there silently and observing is one way to meditate, but becoming conscious in any aspect of your life is another facet of meditation. There's some meditations where you're simply walking slow, concentrating on your hara, on your center, slightly below the navel with your hands there, very slowly walking. Other meditations where you simply look at the blue sky and try to comprehend the blueness. Other meditations are to think about some strange sentence like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Anything that will turn off the mental state of analyzing, criticizing, judging, labeling, separating, cutting apart, and going into the actual experience of this moment. That's the key to meditation, whatever form you do it. And if you're looking for meditations, the Book of Secrets by Osho, the Vigyan Bhairav Tantra, tells you all sorts of meditations, from meditations during lovemaking, to be more conscious of your experience there, to get out of your habitual conceptual things. You know, you think my partner wants this, my partner likes that, and so you do it based upon your mind instead of being truly in your body and experiencing whatever it is that's present for you in the moment right now. So there's 112 meditations in the Book of Secrets, and Osho explains them. You can find a bit about that on my site, bayraba.com. And that is one way to connect to the reality of life, the experience, the experiential things of life, instead of the concepts. Last night, for example, I went out on the deck and just felt the breeze on my skin. And feeling that breeze, yeah, I can label it there as breeze, right? But that's not the experience, is it? But I felt the breeze, and it's an unexplainable, indescribable phenomenon, and it brought me to the here and now. Instead of a conceptual reality, a labeled reality that actually isn't there. And you think, well, how does being connected to the experience help me? Well, that's the point. Your experience is all you really have in this life. So if people are telling you, oh, you've got such a great job, you earn all this money, but you really start to sit with it and start to experience what it's like when you're in that job, you may find that your consciousness is telling you, hey, I really don't enjoy this at all. This doesn't feel good. And these fundamental feelings are what we get distracted from. We have to shut off from them, divorce from them, because we're placed in really, actually, abusive environments, such as school, for such a long time that served basically to disconnect us from what we're feeling and what we're really experiencing. Because if we really connect to our feelings of, you know, sitting at a desk for 9 hours a day listening to teachers talk, think about that as an adult, yeah? And we're prepared for some sort of an office environment while we're doing this, of course. But as we do this, if we're connected to our feelings, we're going to say simply, no, I can't do this, I don't want to do this. So that thus children, quote, act out, and I'm going to get into the consequences of that later. But we're shut off from this. We're not allowed to feel, or we're very, very discouraged from feeling what we're really feeling, from what's really happening, which may lead us in a completely different direction than we are at the moment, and which leads the mind to bring up all sorts of fear to deal with the reality of, oh, what would happen if I follow this feeling and think that everything needs to change. And I've had friends, you know, that's why we keep ourselves busy. That's why we work hard during the day and stay focused on business and money and all of these things. And then we go shopping and use sports and alcohol and whatever we need to do, sex, you know, whatever we need to do to not have to deal with the reality of what's happening. So when you start to add consciousness consciously to something, it's kind of completely undoing the pattern and the system that you're in right now. And I know this sounds like it should be easy, but what happens is when you start to open up and say, okay, what am I really feeling and experiencing, that you will have all sorts of almost insane reactions to what's going on. It's like taking the top off of a boiling pot. All of a sudden, all the pressure gets released, and you start to see how much trauma, violence is being done to you by you. You start to feel everything that isn't harmonious in your life, everything that needs looking at. Everything comes up when you first start doing this. So it's really good to start doing this in a group at the very beginning, because first of all, you don't want to do anything that's painful just naturally. That's normal. It's okay. And this tends to be a very painful, in some ways, experience. So if you do it in a group or with a teacher, you can start to make your first steps and first experiences with meditation and consciousness. And then as you progress, you'll be able to find that you can handle more and more consciousness, longer and longer periods with being in the now, without dropping out, disappearing, coming up with your favorite strategy to deal with it. And all of these feelings that you have, you'll note that they're just feelings. They don't actually do anything. They don't harm you. They don't hurt you. No matter how real they are, no matter how strong they are, you're still here. They don't hurt your body. And they allow you to get the information to actually change your life and respond to life in ways that help you get your authentic needs met, which would otherwise be blocked. So that's a very short primer about labels, beliefs, meditation, and consciousness. And I hope it's helpful. Please send me questions or comments at me@byraba.com. Google Ryan Orok to find that address exactly. But it's B's as in boy and not P's wherever there's a B sound. So byraba.com. You can also find me on Facebook. And subscribe also through iTunes to this if you want to hear more about energy and consciousness and relating and relationships and sexuality and money and community and environment and anything else that I happen to find interesting at the moment. And let me know what you'd like to hear about or discuss as well. And I may also be doing a radio show or a blog talk radio show to deal with this that was shown to me by Stephen Putter, who's my good friend, who's running Imagine Zambia right now. So thank you, everyone, for listening, and I look forward to our next time getting together. This has been Ryan Orok. Bye-bye.